Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So this particular sermon of the Buddha, the Kandaraka Sutta, I chose this for this afternoon's sutta class or Dhamma class for two reasons. The main reason, it's the first of the suttas in this whole collection of the middle-length sayings, the Majjhima Nikaya, which deals with what we know now as the gradual training. Very often that people want to know, how do we actually understand the Buddha's path to enlightenment? How does it all fit together? We know in brief it's the Eightfold Path. But here, the Buddha starts a sequence of practices and trainings which lead to enlightenment, and it was always known as the gradual path to enlightenment. In other words, different grades of practice, of things happening to you in your virtue, your meditation and your wisdom, to the whole practice of enlightenment. So this is something which runs through many, many suttas. Basically, this is how a person becomes enlightened. And also, there's another part of this sutta where the Buddha talks about four types of people: someone who torments themselves, someone who gives other people a hard time, someone who gives both themselves and others a hard time, and lastly, someone who doesn't give anyone a hard time, either themselves or others. And I like this particular framework because, again, I've made a lot of point in the way I've taught Dhamma, the way I've taught meditation in particular, that this is not about tormenting yourself. It's not about experiencing pain and understanding pain. It's about going beyond pain, not tormenting yourself, not tormenting others. Because sometimes, too often, that people think, oh, you've got to sit on broken glass in full lotus, you know, for hours on end, and the more it hurts, the closer you are going to be to enlightenment. And this is not the message of the Buddha, as will come quite clear from this teaching. So those are the two parts of the teaching which I really want to emphasize. Obviously, there's much more which comes up in passing, but we'll see that as we go along. So here we are. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One, meaning the Buddha, was living at Champa on the banks of the Gagara Lake with a large sangha of monks. Then Pessa, the elephant driver's son, and Kandaraka, the wanderer, went to the Blessed One. Wanderer was a person who had left their home. They had both male and female wanderers in the time of the Buddha, and they would wander from place to place. They would not be attached to any particular teacher. They would move from teacher to teacher as they sought for truth, for enlightenment, for spiritual awakening. And obviously, Pessa, the elephant driver's son, that means that was his trade, an elephant trainer, and Kandaraka, the wanderer, went to see the Blessed One. Pessa, after paying homage to the Blessed One, sat down at one side, while Kandaraka exchanged greetings with the Blessed One. And when his courteous and amiable talk was finished, he stood at one side. So that means straight away, according to the customs of that time, that Kandaraka, he wasn't sort of as respectful to the Buddha as Pessa was. Standing there, he surveyed, this is Kandaraka the wanderer, standing there, he surveyed the sangha of monks sitting in complete silence. And then he said to the Blessed One, "It is wonderful, Master Gotama, it is marvelous how the sangha of monks has been led to practice the right way by Master Gotama. Those who were blessed ones, accomplished and fully enlightened in the past, at most only led the sangha of monks to practice the right way as is done by Master Gotama now. And those who will be Buddhas, blessed ones, accomplished and fully enlightened in the future, at most will only lead the sangha of bhikkhus to practice the right way as is done by Master Gotama now." So I actually was praising, got that wrong there. That the Kandaraka was actually quite impressed that basically he was saying that you can't do better than the Buddha's doing now, simply because people were sitting in silence instead of talking with each other when the Buddha was sitting there. And the Buddha replied, "So it is, Kandaraka, so it is. Those who were blessed ones accomplished in 49 in the past, at most only led the Sangha of monks to practice the right way as is done by me now. And those who will be blessed ones accomplished in 49 in the future, at most will only lead the Sangha of monks to practice the right way as it is done by me now. So this is actually saying yes. First of all, you may notice that the Buddha is saying that there were Buddhas in the past and there will be Buddhas in the future. That was accepted by Buddhism. That the Buddha was just that person who happened to fit that particular role at that particular time and place. And when the Dhamma is completely extinct, when there's no teachings of this path of virtue, meditation and wisdom left, then, and only then, can another Buddha arise in the world. Now the Buddha replies, carrying on, Kandaraka, in this Sangha of monks, there are monks who are arahats with their taints, this taints is arsas, these outflowings, destroyed, who have lived a holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and are completely liberated through final knowledge, in other words, fully enlightened. In the Sangha of bhikkhus, there are bhikkhus in higher training, of constant virtue, living a life of constant virtue, sagacious, living a life of constant sagacity. They abide with their minds well established in the four foundations of mindfulness. I usually like to call it the four focuses of mindfulness. What for? Here, Kandaraka, a monk abides contemplating the body, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away the five hindrances. You can see it's a different translation you have there. He abides contemplating feelings, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away the five hindrances. He abides contemplating the mind, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away the five hindrances. He abides contemplating mind objects, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away the five hindrances. You may notice here the difference in the translation before you and what I have said. First of all, you have these words body in body, feelings in feelings, mind in mind, or mind objects in mind objects. That certainly is not a valid translation. This is just the idiom of Pali, always to repeat words where in English we would not repeat them at all. Here, the original translator, Venerable Nyanamoli, who Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi is following, Venerable Nyanamoli did a word-by-word translation instead of doing what Professor A.K. Warder, in his wonderful book, An Introduction to Pali, said, in translating languages, you never translate word-by-word. You translate sentence-by-sentence or phrase-by-phrase because the sentence is a unit of language. In the same way that if you ever look at Pali and study it yourself, you will say they do road sweeping of roads. They dishwash dishes. They toothbrush their teeth. In other words, they always use this almost like a double word for the verb and the object. Sometimes it's repeated. What else would you use a toothbrush for except to brush your teeth? How else could you dishwashing except of dishes? And here it means exactly the same. You do mind contemplation of mind, body contemplation of body, feeling contemplation of feeling. And here they just say it as they contemplate feeling in feeling. Literally it means they do feeling contemplation on feeling. That's the literal meaning. So if you were going to be accurate as a translator, what you would always say is, you just contemplate mind, you just contemplate body, you just contemplate feelings. So there's nothing meant in body, feeling in feeling, mind in mind. That is completely spurious. It's something which has just come up when we translate from Pali into English. It's not originally in the Pali. And number two, to point out, where here we have, and each of these four satipatthanas, as you would know, the four focuses of mindfulness, you find here, he abides contemplating these things, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Now, later on in this sutta, a little interesting part, you will see that covetousness for the world is equivalent to the first of the five hindrances. Actually, when we come to the five hindrances in a few moments, you'll see that is exactly the same word they use. The grief that is also a synonym for the second hindrance of ill will, which is found in two places in the suttas, where they have the list of the usual five hindrances, and instead of vayapada, ill will, they have this word domanassa, here translated as grief. The commentaries to the Satipatthana suttas, there are two of them in the Sutta Pitaka, the teachings of the Buddha, the Mahasatipatthana Sutta in the Digha, and the Satipatthana Sutta here in the Majjhima Nikaya. Both commentaries say this is what those two words mean. Covetousness for the world represents the first hindrance, grief represents the second hindrance, and together they mean the five hindrances. In Pali, it's very common when you have a whole list of things to say the first two, it means the others are also included. It is the way that ancient Buddhist language was meant to be understood. Now, I mention that anyone who likes to understand Satipatthana, it makes a huge amount of difference to understand the meaning of those two terms. Covetousness, what does that really mean? Grief for the world, what does that mean? When I first came across those words, they never made any sense to me. When you understand Pali more deeply, you understand exactly what the Buddha meant to say there, having put aside the five hindrances. That was important. Any comments about that reinterpretation of what we have on here? That, just to make let you know, that first translation, Covetousness and Grief for the World, was made by Professor Rhys Davids. However, 140 years ago now, I think it was, he did the first translations from the Pali using Sinhalese manuscripts into English. He founded the Pali Text Society. It was the first time that the Theravada scriptures had any translations at all into English. And as such, he did an incredibly marvelous job. I mean, it was incredible that how much he got right when he had no one else to help him. However, there was a few little not really mistakes, but he could have got better words for the Pali words. And this, this was one of the things which he wrote, Covetousness and Grief for the World. Maybe it would have made a lot of sense 130, 40 years ago to Victorian England, covetousness. But these days it really doesn't have the same meaning it had those days. But anyway, you can go back to the original Pali and understand those words need to be retranslated as having abandoned the five hindrances. Is that okay?
In modern words, how could it be translated?
We're just having abandoned sensory desire and ill will. Yeah, just what we'd actually use these days. Okay. When this was said, Pessa, the elephant driver's son, said, "It is wonderful, venerable sir, it is marvellous how well the four focuses of mindfulness have been made known by the Blessed One. For the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nibbana. From time to time, venerable sir, we white-clothed lay people meant they were Buddhists. From time to time, venerable sir, we white-clothed lay people also abide with our minds well established in these four focuses of mindfulness. Here, venerable sir, we abide contemplating the body, feelings, mind, and mind objects, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away the five hindrances. It is wonderful, venerable sir." Even in the time of the Buddha, it wasn't just monks and nuns. Everybody would practice this path. "It is wonderful, venerable sir. It is marvellous how amid..." This is a good line. "It is wonderful, venerable sir. It is marvellous how amid man's tangle, corruptions and deceptions, the Blessed One knows the welfare and harm of beings. For humankind is a tangle, but the animal is open enough." Remember, Pessa is an elephant trainer. "Venerable sir, I can drive an elephant to be tamed, and in the time it takes to make a trip back and forth in Champa, that elephant will show every kind of deception, duplicity, crookedness and fraud he is capable of. But those who are called our slaves, messengers and service behave in one way with the body and another way by speech, while their mind works in still another way." In other words, at least the elephant is up front with their deception. People, you don't know what they're up to. It is wonderful, Venerable Sir, it is marvellous how amid man's tangle, corruption and deceptions, the Blessed One knows the welfare and harm of beings. For humankind is a tangle, but the animal is open enough. A very good sort of description there of insight into the nature of human beings and animals. Maybe that's why it is that animals are quite easy to train. Human beings, maybe not. Any comments on that so far? Okay. So it is, Pessa, so it is. Humankind is a tangle, but the animal is open enough. Pessa, there are four kinds of person to be found existing in the world. What for? Here, a certain kind of person torments himself and pursues a practice of torturing himself. Here, a certain kind of person torments others and pursues a practice of torturing others. Here, a certain kind of person torments himself and pursues a practice of torturing himself, and he also torments others and pursues a practice of torturing others. Here, a certain kind of person does not torment himself or pursue the practice of torturing himself, and he does not torment others or pursue the practice of torturing others. Since he torments neither himself nor others, he is here and now hungerless, extinguished and cooled, and he abides experiencing bliss, having himself become holy. So they're equating straight away that fourth option of actually the path to enlightenment. Which of these four kinds of persons satisfies your mind, Pessa? Quite obviously, he said, the first three do not satisfy my mind, Venerable Sir, but the last one satisfies my mind. But, Pessa, why don't the first three kinds of person satisfy your mind? Venerable Sir, the kind of person who torments himself and pursues a practice of torturing himself, torments and tortures himself, though he desires pleasure and recoils from pain. That is why this kind of person does not satisfy my mind. And the kind of person who torments others and pursues a practice of torturing others, torments and tortures others who also desire pleasure and recoil from pain. That is why this kind of person does not satisfy my mind. And the kind of person who torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing himself, and who also torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others, torments himself and tortures himself and others, both of whom desire pleasure and recoil from pain. That is why this kind of person does not satisfy my mind. But the kind of person who does not torment himself or pursue the practice of torturing himself, and who does not torment others or pursue the practice of torturing others, who since he torments neither himself nor others, is here and now hungerless, extinguished and cooled, and abides experiencing bliss, having himself become holy, he does not torment or torture either himself or others, both of whom desire pleasure and recoil from pain. That is why this kind of person satisfied my mind. And now, Venerable Sir, we are departing. We are busy and have much to do. Now is the time, Pessa, to do as you think. Now is the time, Pessa, to do as you think fit. That was actually the standard way of telling people to go. Yasadani tumhe kalamanyata. So that's in Pali to say, okay, off you go. But it's very polite. Then Pessa, the elephant driver's son, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's words, rose from his seat and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right, he departed. And soon after he had left, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, Bhikkhus, Pessa, the elephant driver's son, is wise. He has great wisdom. If he had sat a while longer until I had expounded for him in detail these four kinds of persons, he would have greatly benefited. Still, he has already greatly benefited as it is. So sometimes when people are in a bit of a rush and they leave, who knows what might have happened if they'd stuck around. So now the monks, obviously they've got the hint from the Buddha, So they say, this is the time, Blessed One, this is the time, Sublime One, for the Blessed One to expound in detail these four kinds of persons. Having heard it from the Blessed One, the monks will remember it. Then monks, listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, Venerable Sir, the monks replied, and the Blessed One said this. So, is there anything anyone would like to say before we carry on to get the main part of the sutta? Now, this next part of the sutta, it gives you an idea of what in those days was the spiritual practice of many people about tormenting themselves, and obviously what happens when you torment others, or you do both. And then afterwards, what is the practice of neither tormenting others and not tormenting yourself, the path to enlightenment? Let's see what the Buddha means here. The first particular path was very much a description of the practice of those who were called Jains in the time of the Buddha, who had these very, very hard practices with the idea that somehow if you experienced a lot of pain in this life, you'd be able to burn off all your old bad karma, and thereby once you were free of karma, you wouldn't have to get reborn anymore. So they're actually looking for finding out some pain. And like many religious people, sometimes that if you see someone doing very hard, tormenting things, sometimes people think they're saints. You know, just because. And in the time of the Middle Ages, there were some people who would live on the top of these old columns. And in the Grecian and Roman columns, they would climb up to the top of these columns, live on the platform. Those of you who've been to Trafalgar Square in London, you see the column with Nelson on top. That's only a statue. This is a real person who would sit on top of these columns. And they would live on there for years. And people would, you know, actually come to the bottom, and they'd ask, you know, for advice on their meditation, on their marriage, or whatever else. And these were like the holy people. They never lived in caves on top of mountains. They lived on top of these columns. You know, the columns were called stylus. So these were actually stylites. That was the name of this group of so-called holy people. And they were just really into all sorts of torturing things. There was one guy, I think Simon Stylites, who would wear a belt around his waist. He would never wash. And whenever he'd move, all these maggots would fall out. And he thought, wow, that must be a really holy people. And of course, you know the joke about that. So that was the origin of the agony column. That's what they say. That wasn't my joke. That actually came from the BBC many years ago when I saw a documentary about that. So religion is littered with people doing extreme practices, which is tormenting oneself. And the Buddha makes it very clear that is not the way to become enlightened. So here comes a list of weird and strange things which people would do in the time of the Buddha. Remember, when you didn't have movies and documentaries or sci-fi, this was the nearest people could get to sort of getting interested in the weird and wonderful in the time of the Buddha. Monks, what kind of person torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing himself? Here a certain person goes naked, rejecting conventions. Now, sometimes you go naked in most parts of the year, but imagine going naked early this morning or yesterday morning. It was cold enough with clothes on, let alone with no clothes on. Licking his hands, which is instead of washing them, not coming when asked. When they say, come and have some food, they won't come when they're asked. Not stopping when asked. These are practices of Jains that if they ask you to come and get some food, you can't accept it. You can't stop just because someone's offering you food. They just almost have to put it in your bowl or whatever as you are walking. He does not accept food bought or food specially made on an invitation to a meal. He receives nothing from a pot, from a bowl, across a threshold, across a stick, across a pestle. He doesn't receive from two eating together, doesn't receive from a pregnant woman, from a woman giving suck, from a woman lying with a man, from where food is advertised to be distributed, from where a dog is waiting, must get the dog to eat first of all, from where flies are buzzing, even flies get first dibs, as they say. He accepts no fish or meat, he drinks no liquor, wine or fermented brew, he keeps to one house to one morsel. In other words, when he went arms round in the morning, he'd only go to one house, and if they gave him something, fine. If they gave him nothing, he would not go to a second house, or to one morsel, just one mouthful, two houses and two morsels, seven houses and seven morsels. He lives on a saucerful a day, or two saucerful a day, or seven saucerfuls a day. He takes food once a day, once every 2 days, once every 7 days, and so on up to once every fortnight. He dwells pursuing the practice of taking food at stated intervals. He is an eater of greens or millet or wild rice or hide parings or moss or rice bran or rice gum or sesame flour or grass or cow dung. People would actually eat cow dung in the time of the Buddha, which is going a bit far, but I suppose, you know, people get the taste for it after a while. He lives on forest roots and fruits. He feeds on fallen fruits. That means that's all he ever eats. Goes into the forest. If he finds some fallen fruits, he eats. If he doesn't, he fasts. They clothe themselves in hemp mixed cloth, in shrouds, in other words, what you get from the grave sites, in refuse rags, in tree bark, in antelope hide, in strips of antelope hide, in kusa grass fabric. That kusa grass is very, very sharp and can very easily cut you. In bark fabric, in wood shaving fabrics, in head hair wool, in animal wool, in owl's wings. Always, because that's, we're specifically prohibited. That's one of our rules. We're not allowed to wear robes made out of owl's wings. And I always wondered about, what about the poor owls? Why haven't they got enough stuff for owl's wings? It's very weird. But anyway, that was one of the things they did. He is one who pulls out the hair and beard. In other words, instead of shaving, you actually pluck out every hair and every, because it keeps growing back again, so you just have to keep plucking all the time. He is one who squats continuously. He is one who stands continuously. You don't reject all seats. He is one who squats continuously, devoted to maintaining the squatting position. Don't lie down, don't stand. He is one who uses a mattress as spikes. You know, those ascetics in India, you know, on the spike beds, even in the time of the Buddha, people were into that sort of stuff. He makes a mattress of spikes his bed. He dwells pursuing the practice of bathing in water 3 times daily, including the evening. That's really funny, isn't it? Because we think, wow, we do that. But in the time of the Buddha, remember, that wasn't hot water. And that was a bit of a hassle even finding the water. And that was actually supposed to be a tormenting practice. You ask some of the young children in your house and they would agree, yeah, that's going a bit too far, leave a baby once a day. Thus, in such a variety of ways, he dwells pursuing the practice of tormenting and mortifying the body. This is called the kind of person who torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing himself. And of course, you can see that was just the description of some of the weird practices people would do in that day. But I think you can get the message here. That anything which is just so tough and hard on your body, even fasting, say that's not the right practice. That's just tormenting and torturing yourself. What kind of person torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others? Here a certain person is a butcher of sheep, of pigs, a fowler, which just means you keep chickens and kill them, a trapper of wild beasts, a hunter, a fisherman, a thief, an executioner, a prison warden. Now, some prison wardens, you know, are members of our Buddhist society, but remember, the prison wardens of those days, part of your job would be to torture people. So, now, a prison warden today is not quite the same as a prison warden in the time of the Buddha. So, you know, a prison warden today, you'd sort of exempt from this list. Or one who follows any other such bloody occupation. This is called the kind of person who torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others. What kind of person, monks, torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing himself and also torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others? There's some interesting examples here. Here, some person is a head-anointed noble king or well-to-do Brahmin, having had a new sacrificial temple built to the east of the city and having shaved off his hair and beard, dressing himself in rough hide and greased his body with ghee and oil, scratching his back with a deer's horn, he enters a sacrificial temple together with his chief queen and his Brahmin high priest. And this might seem a bit weird, but this is actually some of the Hindu traditions which happened in those days. There he lies down on the bare ground with grass on it. The king lives on the milk in the first teat of the cow with a calf of the same colour, while the chief queen lives on the milk in the second teat and a Brahmin high priest. This is really weird stuff. The Brahmin high priest lives on the milk in the third teat. The milk in the fourth teat they pour into the fire. And the calf lives on what is left. Poor calf. He says thus, let so many bulls be slaughtered for sacrifice. Let so many bullocks be slaughtered for sacrifice. Let so many heifers be slaughtered for sacrifice. Let so many goats be slaughtered for sacrifice. Let so many sheep be slaughtered for sacrifice. Let so many trees be felled for the sacrificial post. Let so much grass be cut for the sacrificial grass. And then his slaves, messengers, and servants make preparations, weeping with tearful faces, being spurred on by threats of punishment and by fear. In other words, they have to do the work. They don't want to do it, but they just are forced to do it. This is called the kind of person who torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing himself, and torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others. In other words, doing bad deeds yourself and making other people do those bad deeds as well. Just again an example from the society in which the Buddha lived. And those sacrificial animals, unfortunately, I think now this practice is completely finished in Nepal, but I do remember going to Kathmandu as the first stage of one of the pilgrimages to India, and a tour guide took all of us to the sites of Kathmandu, one of which was the old royal palace. And I was getting bored and just, you know, left the group and wandered through one of the doorways, and I came into this courtyard which gave me the creeps. One of the worst places I've ever been. It just felt terrible. And I asked the guide afterwards, what happens in there? And that was where once a year the king of Nepal would do a Hindu ceremony of slaughtering animals, tying to the post and killing them all there. And that was the place they did it in. And that was just such a rotten place. You know, just anyone with any sort of sensitivity would go in there and want to get out as soon as possible. That's tormenting others and tormenting yourself. So, any type of tormenting yourself or tormenting others, giving either a hard time, is not the way to enlightenment. So here we go, the fourth practice. This is a nice practice. But before I start, has anyone got any comments on what went on so far? Oh, that's right, yeah. That's right, yeah. That was actually... Again, this is not demanded of prison warders in a country like Australia. Their job is actually to look after the security of those prisoners, not to actually to harm them at all. However, there are some prison warders who take upon themselves to make things tough for the people who are supposed to be under their care. And for those of you who don't know that story, it's one of the prisoners who I was teaching meditation to. Again, this was in the jail in Canning Vale. Somebody told me the name of it. It's not Banksia, Hakea? Hakea, yeah, thank you. Hakea prison. And he told me he came to the class, he said, you know, he was very into his meditation. He would get up early in the morning and in his cell he'd be sitting there quietly. But the guards would actually come and check on him every half an hour. And when they'd open the hatch, they'd see him meditating in there. They'd get very upset and they'd take their flashlight and they'd rattle it against those railings to make as much noise as possible, bang on the door and shine the light in his face as much as they could. And you know, he said, can you not complain to the superintendent? I can't say anything, but you can. Look, well, they're giving me a hard time. And I'm trying to meditate, do something good for myself. And of course, you know the answer which I gave him, the typical answer, look, what you should do is just sit there, make peace with it, be kind to that officer, don't get upset or agitated. You just sit there and just make peace with the whole experience. I could tell the superintendent, but this is the better practice for you. And of course he was upset at first, but then he did that. And a couple of weeks later, when I went to see him again, it's great, it worked. Because all he did, when that sort of officer, prison officer, started making all that noise and trying to disturb him, he just made himself so peaceful he didn't move. You know, which really upset the prison officer, who tried banging harder and harder, still he didn't move. And of course, what happened next? Prison officer gave up. Never made any noise ever again. He wasted time because the man wasn't getting upset. So he said, he gave you a trial, you passed, so you're free now. That's a wonderful little teaching he got there. When people try and irritate you, yeah, you can sort of try and use your rights or get other people to help you. But it's much better just to sit there and be so peaceful and don't even move. And then people think, what's the point of getting angry or trying to disturb this person? They just won't get disturbed. It's a great little anecdote there. Okay, now this is a nice part of the sutta, because this is where it gets to the point of the gradual training, which is not tormenting other people, not tormenting yourself. What kind of person, monks, does not torment himself or pursue the practice of torturing himself, or does not torment others or pursue the practice of torturing others? The one who, since they torment neither themselves or others, is here and now hungerless, extinguished and cooled, and abides experiencing bliss, having themselves become holy. Notice a few things there. When you don't torment others, you have no hunger, in other words, no craving, no desires. Extinguished, this is nibbānat. And cooled, the idea of all the desires, the attachments, the sufferings, all that, the heat in the mind, in the body. And experiencing bliss, having themselves become holy. When a person becomes enlightened, they're not like a vegetable. It's not like being in a coma and feeling nothing. Enlightened people are blissed out people. So experiencing bliss. So sometimes people think that an enlightened person has no emotions at all, experiencing neither happiness nor suffering. No. Enlightened people experiencing bliss, themselves becoming holy woman, holy man. Here, monks, and this is the standard description, a Tathagata, which was the Buddha's own name for a Buddha. A Buddha appears in the world, accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of the worlds. What that means here, the worlds, the three worlds, means the world of the five senses, including the heaven realms, the hell realms, and the two jhana realms, the jhana realm and the immaterial realm. These are like called the tiloka, the three worlds. So not just this human world, it doesn't mean sort of Mars and other planets in the universe. What it means here is in particular this whole physical universe, and also the heaven realms, the ghost realms, the hell realms, but the other two realms which are based on the jhana, the mind-made realms and the perception-made realms. Those are the three worlds. So someone who understands these three worlds, the knower of the worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed. And I think many of you who were listened to the morning chanting on Saturdays and Sundays before Dana in the hall, or who do the chanting on a Friday evening between 7 and 7:30, may remember this as Itipiso Bhagava Alahang Sama Sambuddho Vijja Chavana Sampano Sukato Loka Vidu Rutaro Pursa Dhamma Sarati Sata Deva Manasana Buddha Bhagavati. Very standard Buddhist chant. And those chants, they're actually just snippets from the suttas. So this is actually where that one comes from. He declares this world with its gods, its Maras. Mara is the personification of delusion, and also a being who is in the biggest power trip. Well, that's another talk, but I'll pass over that. And its princes and people, which he has himself realized by direct knowledge. He teaches the Dharma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. With the right meaning of phrasing, he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. So Buddha arises and teaches. Does anyone want to say anything about this so far? Okay. A householder or householder's son or daughter or one born in some other clan hears the Dhamma. On hearing the Dhamma, they acquire faith in the Buddha. Possessing that faith, they consider thus. Household life is crowded and dusty. Life gone forth is wide open. It is not easy, while living in the home, to lead the holy life, utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Those conch shells, when they're polished, become very shiny and just like pure. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from home life into homelessness. So as a person having faith, you think, well, you can actually practice, you know, pretty well in the at home. But you know that you've all tried that. It is difficult at times, you know, living a home life and actually practicing 100% meditation and Dhamma. And this is what they were taught in those days. Household life is difficult. But, you know, if I actually go forth, shave off hair and beard, put on a yellow robe, then I might do better. On a later occasion, abandoning a small or a large fortune, abandoning a small or large circle of relatives, they shave off their hair and beard, put on a yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. So in other words, they become monks or nuns. Having thus gone forth and possessing the monks' training and way of life, and here we have what it is, abandoning the killing of living beings, they abstain from killing living beings with rod and weapon laid aside, gentle and kindly. They abide compassionate to all living beings. So it's not just not killing any living beings, but deliberately taking care of them. So it's true, for example, if you know you're walking on the path and you tread on the snow because you don't see it, yeah, that's not breaking the precept. But really what you should be doing is actually looking out for the snails. Or if you see one there, picking them up and putting them on the grass or outside of the path so the people walking behind you don't step on them. It's like trying to not just keep your precepts and just not kill, but abiding gentle and kindly, compassionate to all living beings. The second one, abandoning the taking of what is not given. They abstain from taking what is not given, taking only what is given. In other words, that you know what people give to you, don't just help yourself. You're expecting only what is given. By not stealing, he abides in purity. Abandoning in celibacy, you observe celibacy, living apart from the opposite gender, abstaining from the practice of sexual intercourse. Abstaining from false speech, you abstain from false speech, you speak the truth. Adhere to the truth, so you're someone who's trustworthy and reliable, one who is no deceiver of the world, which is actually what really lying is, not deceiving people. So, you know, you may tell a joke about the Englishman, Irishman, Scotsman, but it doesn't mean that's true. You know, you're not expecting to be deceive people. People know it's a joke when you start telling them. So lying here is actually deliberately trying to sort of deceive another person. So you're no deceiver of the world. You abandon malicious speech, and you abstain from malicious speech. In other words, you don't repeat elsewhere what you've heard here in order to divide those people from these, nor do you repeat to these people what he had heard elsewhere in order to divide those people from those. In other words, this is malicious gossip. Thus, he is one, or she is one, who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendship, who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, delights in concord, a speaker of words that promote concord. And that's a beautiful example of just how, you know, when we have gossip, if it's positive gossip, as I said in the talk a couple of weeks ago, positive gossip is when you say, have you heard a wonderful thing about Ong? You just give a really good sort of meditation yesterday afternoon. And then Ong feels good about that, everyone else feels good about that. That's positive gossip. And that creates like harmony and concord. You know, if I say something else, you wouldn't believe what he was teaching yesterday afternoon. That was absolutely rotten, stupid. If you say things like that, of course, you know, that creates a lot of discord, a disharmony. So this is what we mean by the difference between malicious gossip and what I mentioned, positive gossip, spreading good rumours about other people. Now, like I'm always very happy, I think Mary was telling me just what a wonderful job, say, Ajahn Bhamani did last week, because there was a precept day, an 8 precept day, a flower puja day, and he gave a very beautiful metta meditation. And that's like positive gossip. I love hearing things like that. You know, about what nice things people do. But so, here as a monk, you avoid the malicious gossip. So you're not trying to divide people. You abandon harsh speech. So you abstain from harsh speech. You speak such words as are gentle, pleasing to the ear, and lovable as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by many, and agreeable to many. And I love that sort of part about not harsh speech. I don't call people stupid or a donkey, you idiot, fatso. You know, you actually use nice speech. You know, venerable, you know, you're a wonderful teacher, you know, you're putting on a lot of weight, but you know, it must be because you don't worry enough. Whatever else it is, this nice, kind speech, you don't have to use harsh speech to get the message across. So it's amazing how many people, just the way they speak, is somebody were complaining to me because there's a character, a celebrity chef or something, and they came to complain to me. What was his name?
Ramsay.
Oh, that's right, yeah, Ramsay. And he said he's got a TV show, and he said it's just disgusting just how he acts. And that's completely opposite of, you know, what we're trying to encourage in this world. No gentle speech. You know, so, you know, if somebody's just doesn't know how to boil the egg when they're sort of trying to be a chef, I said, listen, that's not the way to boil an egg. You know, you sort of got to put it in the hot water first of all. Just put it in there gently and just, there's a clock over there, you know, 3 minutes for soft boil, 5 minutes for hard boil. That's all you need to do, okay? Unfortunately, I don't think people watch it if they have on the TV. But, I mean, that's what... And of course, when you're taught like that, they're pleased and they go, that's what you want to hear. And actually, you get much more out of a person when you're kind to them. So that's actually that you avoid harsh speech. And lastly, you abandon gossip. But what gossip means here? He abstains from gossip. He speaks at the right time, speaks what is fact, speaks on what is good, speaks on the Dharma and the discipline. At the right time, he speaks words as a worth recording, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. So this is actually not what we mean by gossip these days. It means like stupid, worthless speech. You know, speaking too much. Just being like motor mouth. Instead of actually just as... I mentioned this in a talk, and it was published in that our latest ET newsletter. If you can't improve upon the silence, be quiet. A great little saying. If you cannot improve upon the silence... be quiet. So not talking too much. That's what it means here. So this is, again, this is part of the not tormenting or harming others of a monk. You abstain from injuring seeds and plants. So, you know, as a monk, we're just really eco-friendly. You know, we try and sort of look after the plants and the trees and the grasses. You practice eating in only one part of the day, abstaining from eating at night and outside the proper time. This is a monk's rule of only eating in the morning time. You abstain from dancing, singing, music and theatrical shows. So you never see like the nuns sort of dancing, nor the monks singing. It's a good job too, because we'd have terrible voices. You abstain from wearing garlands and smartening yourself with scents and embellishing yourself with unguents. You abstain from high and large couches. That's the eighth precept. In other words, it doesn't mean actually high and large, it means expensive or extravagant beds. You won't find a four-poster bed, or a water bed, or a king bed in our monastery. You abstain from accepting gold and silver, which is actually money in those days. So this is monks are not supposed to have money. You abstain from accepting raw grain. So, you know, we don't sort of keep food or of accepting raw meat. You know, we're not supposed to have supplies. You abstain from accepting women and girls, for obvious reason. You abstain from accepting men and women slaves. You abstain from accepting goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares. Abstain from accepting fields and lands. In other words, we're not... all those things which were... the measure of a person's wealth in the time of the Buddha, you know, slaves, gold, silver, money, horses, elephants, you know, whatever, those were not what a person is supposed to have once they've left the world. In other words, we should have hardly any possessions at all. He abstained from going on errands and running messages. He abstained from buying and selling. You abstain from false weights, false metals, and false measures. So monks and nuns are not allowed to play the stock market. Or for gambling. Well, I think I mentioned, I confessed my terrible act, I think a couple of weeks ago, when I went to the ordination of the first Australian female bishop, because I was invited. And that was when I found out a few days before that the Dean of St. George's Cathedral, John Shepherd, you know, he's given a talk here, one Rains Retreat, he's a good friend. And apparently at one Buddhist ceremony in Supreme Court Gardens, you know, I was going, he was going to give a talk, and I rang him up. He said, "Are you going?" I said, "Yeah, I'm going." He said, "It's going to rain again, isn't it?" I said, "No, it's not going to rain." He said, "Oh, it is." I said, "No, it's not. It's a Buddhist ceremony." He said, "I'll bet you $2 it's going to rain." And I said, "Okay, you're on." I shouldn't have said things like that, because it did rain, so I owed him $2. And he was... And unfortunately, because, you know, I encourage people to, you know, to mingle with other faiths and not just to be sort of born again Buddhist and make this a cult. And so some common friends were telling me that he was going around saying, "Oh, Ajahn Brahm owes him $2, he's not paying off his gambling debts." He was just being cheeky, and I was as cheeky. So when I went to this ceremony, I was looking out for him with the Anangarika. I had $2, so I actually managed to find him so I could actually pay off all my gambling debts. So now I'm free. So I've got to be careful sometimes what you say. But, you know, we're not supposed to do gambling and stuff, but that was just a joke. Sorry? No, $2 from the petty cash. So, it wasn't receipted, by the way, so I'd be embarrassed. Anyway, where was I going here? So you abstained from buying and selling, from false weights, metals and false measures. You abstained from cheating, deceiving, defrauding and trickery. You abstained from, because even like a, for example, you could do like a fundraising, you know, for something, and just the monk puts it in his own account or uses it for wrong things. And that's, you can't do things like that, that's wrong. Abstain from wounding, murdering, binding, bigotage, plunder and violence. In other words, you keep a sort of virtue which, you know, a person who's left the world is supposed to keep. Otherwise you're tormenting yourself and tormenting others at the same time. So you can actually see in here that those of you who've got to know our monks and nuns over many years, sometimes you see in here some of the reasons why we do what we do, not having any gold and silver, not having any money or bank accounts. And whatever we have in communal property rather than personal property. We don't have our own huts, you know, it belongs to the monasteries. So you can see here like a basic virtue of one who's gone forth. Now, much more than just a basic virtue, we've also got simplicity coming next. So this is not really harming anybody, it's not immoral what comes next, but this is just the basic rules of living a simple life. Paragraph 15, you become content with the robes to protect your body and with alms food to maintain your stomach. So you're not having robes which look nice, you know, with sort of a Gucci lame robe which sparkles on Friday night when the lights go on me. And alms food just to maintain your stomach, not just because it tastes nice, but because it just maintains ease and health. And this is what I really like. And wherever you go, you set out taking only these with them, just as a bird, wherever it goes, flies with its wings as its only burden. So too, the monk or nun becomes content with a robe to protect their body and with alms food to maintain their stomach. And wherever they go, they set out taking only these with them. When I first read that, I was so inspired, and I'm still inspired by that. You're like a bird. Remember, people say a bird with no suitcases. So, even on Tuesday, I'm going off to Toronto. It's a long journey. If anyone sees me at the airport, you see me with my bag over here and my bowl, and that's it. No suitcases. I really try hard to do that, to be a bird. Just fly with hardly any burdens. That's what a monk is supposed to be, and a nun too. Now, what happens? Possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, harmlessness and simplicity, they experience with themselves a bliss that is blameless. Now this gradual training here, you see this is the first level of happiness which comes up. It's called the Anavajrasukha, the blameless happiness. Sometimes people say, why do you want to keep virtuous precepts anyway? It's a burden. No, it makes you happy. And people who keep precepts, even 5 precepts, 8 precepts every now, simplify their life. It's not a hard thing to do. It's a happy thing to do. It's exactly what the Buddha is saying here. The blameless, simple, unburdened happiness. The first level of happiness. But there's more to come yet. Yeah. Give the precepts, simplify. You know, do more than the precepts. Don't just not kill beings. Be trying to be kind to beings, looking after their welfare. It's not just not taking what's not stealing, making sure you don't take what's not given to you. And don't ask for things from the government you don't deserve. You look at the speech. You know, that's always a very difficult one to keep, to make sure there's no malicious gossip. Always kind words. If you're going to tell someone off, tell them off with gentle words and don't talk too much. Yes, simplicity. You may not be able to get to the point of just having your alms food and robes, because if you try and go on alms round, no one will give anything into you. So, you know, you've got to keep your job or something. But you can simplify a lot. And I just see there's just big houses people have these days. And 2 people live in them, 1. Yeah, okay, you have a room there in case somebody visits, but how often do they visit? Wouldn't it be easier to have a smaller house if your relations visit? Get them a hotel room. At least it means you get rid of them at night time. You can have a bit of peace and quiet to yourself. Wouldn't that be wonderful? That's what hotels are there for. You have a small house, nice and easy to look after. You have much more peace and happiness. But we have these huge houses these days. How many people live in those houses? Sometimes just 1, 2. How many rooms have you got in your house? I've got 1 room in my cave. Okay, so that is downsizing, simplifying. Paragraph 16. Now, on seeing a form with the eye, you do not grasp at its signs and features, since if you left the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief, in other words, hindrances, might invade them. So you practice a way of restraint. You guard the eye faculty, undertake restraint of the eye faculty. So in other words, you may be passing the shops, and there's this, I don't know what you like, say, a chocolate eclair. You can see it in the shop as you go past. Oh, that looks really nice. Be careful. Stop looking. Guard the eye faculty. Otherwise, covetousness will quickly invade the mind. Oh, I have to have that, I have to have that. And before you know it, you've got to bought it. Well, be careful with the eye faculty. In other words, you see things and sometimes desire can come up. Men, you might see a pretty girl. What happens? You go to the, what is it? It does not grasp at its signs and its features. Instead of just seeing that as a human being, so a male with lust sees the most beautiful parts of it, the stuff which creates the excitement. And this is actually how we can stop the lust. The same with a female looking at the male. Just not look at those parts which excites you, or those features which is going to sort of inflame your lust. So, but what we usually do, because we're unguarded, we allow our mind, or rather to guide our sort of our eye, we just go and look at whatever excites us the most. Or if we're in a bad mood, we look at things which we want to sort of justify our bad mood, and our senses go in that direction. The same with our hearing. On hearing a sound with the ear, sometimes we can just take some of that sound, some of those intonations. So we grasp the details, we sort of miss out the whole, and it's those details which make us angry. He said this, he should have said that. You know, or she didn't mention this when she should have done. We grasp the details, we're unguarded, and we allow these evil, unwholesome states to infect our mind. We're not guarding. Now, by guarding, it doesn't mean we don't look, we don't hear. We're not like those five monkeys. It means we do see, but we're mindful enough to make sure we don't look in such a way that we get sort of lust or anger, ill will arising in our mind. So if you are, I teach this to my monks, especially young monks, if you've still got a lot of lust, you know, the fact that you've got a young body and you've still got those hormones raging in your bloodstream, if you do see a beautiful woman in there, guard your senses, not just by closing your eyes, but try and see something else in her which is not so attractive. To see, she's just a being, she's not sort of a sex object. You know, if a woman sort of sees a guy, you know, which, you know, turns you on, don't look for that part of them which creates lust. Unless you're looking for a partner, you want to get sort of lusty. But, you know, if you want to restrain yourself because it's not your partner, you've already got a partner, look for something in them which suppresses that lust. If it's anger which comes up when you see someone, look for something which doesn't upset you, their redeeming features, you know, how kind they are, or the wonderful service they do. So that way, when you're using your senses, you guide them so that you don't have to have all these terrible defilements raging in your mind, like ill will, anger, resentment, or desire and ill will. This is called guarding the senses. And the same with hearing a sound, with the ear, smelling an odor with the nose, a flavor with the tongue, touching a tangible with the body, or actually feeling something in the body, or cognizing a mind object with the mind, even thinking about something. You do not grasp at its signs and its features. You see the whole thing if you want. Since you've left the mind faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief, in other words, five hindrances, desire and ill will, might invade you. So you practice a way of restraint of the senses. You guard the mind faculty and all the other faculties. You undertake the restraint of the sense faculties. Possessing this noble restraint of the six senses, you experience within yourself a bliss that is unsullied. Unsullied by these, that's why we call them defilements. These, you know, this lust, this greed, this ill will, this resentment, this jealousy, this fear. These are all unwholesome states of mind which take away your happiness. And remember, it's not caused by what another person looks like or what they say or the smells, tastes and touches. It's very much caused by the fact you haven't used your senses wisely and you've allowed yourself to get upset, to get inflamed. With guarding the senses, with this restraint, it means you've got this beautiful peace. You don't get upset at others. Oh, they can call you a pig. Oh, it just doesn't matter. You can see beautiful people, ugly people. You can get more at peace. And then you get the unsullied happiness. Another type of bliss, which is even higher, more intense than the bliss of keeping precepts. You're beginning to train your mind rather than just be completely out of control, using what we call sense restraint. Remember, sense restraint is not just closing off all your senses. It's using them wisely. Okay? Yeah? It's a good question, because yes, it is good to enjoy the food, but up to a certain point. In other words, you enjoy the food because if you didn't enjoy the food, the saliva, the bile, all those other chemicals which come out of your body too, digestive food will not come out. So it's to enjoy the food up to a point, but not to sort of get so into it. The enjoyment is there just for the sake of good digestion, but not to the sake of just indulging so you want to eat more. Does that make sense? Certainly, yes. So you're not so much for the taste, but for the sake of its giving you a bit more energy, a bit more slaking your thirst.
What's wrong with enjoying the taste?
It's good with enjoying the taste because that's important. This is when I remember seeing a video, a documentary of the Zen monastery in Japan, a Heiji monastery, which is supposed to be one of the strictest monasteries. And they made a point in there that when they're doing the cooking, that has to make it delicious for everybody. And when I first heard that, I thought, that's just indulging. You should enjoy your food. Remember, I spent years in northeast Thailand eating disgusting food. And I thought, you should just be like we used to be. We're the real monks, disgusting food. Those in those days. These days we eat very nice food. I actually told the monks the other day, because I just came back from this five-star resort in Thailand where we were. This group in Singapore had hired a whole hotel for our meditation retreat. And so, you know, all the people, they were just doing the same food as they would normally do for their guests. And then I compared that food which we had in this five-star resort in Khao Lak in Thailand. And actually, it's not as good as the food we get every day at Bodhinyana Monastery. That actually, you give really incredible food. And it's six-star. And someone told me that the nuns' monastery gets better food than the monks do. I don't know. That's what I was told. So that must be seven-star at Dharamsala. But it is enjoyable food. And this particular documentary made me really think, why were you supposed to have that? And why did the Buddha not actually say that, you know, the food should be disgusting? And it's obvious because, you know, when the food is delicious, that's when it gets digested. Because, you know, if you try and eat bland food, a lot of the monks, when we had that terrible food, we did have indigestion problems. And just my basic biology, you know, you need. If you want to prove that, think of your favorite food right now. Close your eyes, think of it, you can always smell it. And you'll find saliva comes out of your mouth. Just even the thought of it, of enjoyable food, saliva comes out. Now think of something disgusting to eat, like, you know, think of like eating sort of like cow dung, as it just said a few pages ago. Does saliva come out? No. So if you try to eat cow dung, you know, it would not get digested. No saliva would come out. So the delight in the food is necessary for digestion, that's all. But obviously if you get too much into just the delight in food, you get sort of very choosy and picky and demanding. So enjoy the food, but without being demanding. So there's a limit there. Yeah? Yeah. 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 It is, because that becomes, oh actually we're supposed to be recording this, these questions. But if people go into small houses or they cut off their coffee, they cut off their tea, they just eat plain rice or whatever, and they usually get very miserable. That's a very good observation. I've seen that a lot of times in my life as a monk. They are really tormenting themselves. So they're just going too far. So there is, say like with even food, there is, you know, that sort of right level there where the food is enjoyable enough to be digested so that you have an easy digestion, not sort of having to bother too much with the pains of the gut. As far as other things, I mean, you don't need to sort of to see movies, to watch TV, to listen to CDs of your favorite musician, or to, I'm not sure what other people do for pleasures. Those aren't so necessary for a healthy body. So food, you have to eat food, you have to eat water or drinks or something. So those are obviously allowable by the Buddha according to our rules, because they do give like a healthy, easy body. You go too far, and you do actually start tormenting yourself. So something that obviously I sleep on the floor. I've only got very thin mats to sleep on. Fortunately, I can still do that. But if my back gives up and I can't still do that anymore, I'm going to get a mattress and sleep on or something. But at the moment, I can do that because back's pretty good. But so you're not doing this just to prove just how ascetic you are. You're doing this as long as it's comfortable. So you know you have enough blankets when you sleep. to keep warm so you have a decent night's sleep, but not too many blankets. It's too much to push up in the morning to get out of bed. So you can see that comfort without indulgence. Does that make sense? Not yet. Okay. Okay, yeah. Yeah. Indeed, that's what you were saying there, was that the four right efforts is whatever you need to do to abandon unwholesome states, to keep unwholesome states out, and actually to arouse wholesome states and keep those wholesome states there for a long time, to keep this beautiful peace and stillness and happiness there. And I like what it says here, that if you didn't guard, say, how much you eat, or the flavors. You're not saying you don't eat delicious food, but if you don't guard that and sort of eat too much or too little, then the evil unwholesome states of mind come up. You get stomach ache or you just get bloated. It's the same whatever else you do, if you know the how you sleep. You've got to guard sort of your sleeping. Too much and you get sort of dull. Too little, you get sort of tired and sick. You've got to find that middle way. And again, it is the case that everyone has their own little middle way there of how much. But it's not experiencing sights or sounds or smells or tastes. It's just knowing that right amount so that the good states increase. So basically, so let's say here the five hindrances don't invade the mind. You don't get sort of more desire. You don't get sort of more ill will or negativity and miserable. Very good, yeah, because the right effort is, you know, it's the goal determines what the right effort is. And, you know, so often the right effort is being very gentle, being kind, just letting go. It's the best way of allowing wholesome states to arise. Okay, but this is the next level of bliss, of like, because you're working with your six senses, you're not just allowing them free rein to do whatever they will, you are actually creating a deeper happiness. And after sense restraint, one becomes one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending your limbs, acts in full awareness when wearing robes, carrying the outer robe and bowl, full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, one acts in full awareness when defecating and urinating, full awareness when walking, standing, falling asleep, waking up, talking and keeping silent. So this is very much the mindfulness practices which people practice in some meditation retreats. So instead of just eating and talking to the person next to you, you're eating and you're experiencing the food, the one spoon at a time practice. So you're not worrying about the food left in the bowl. You eat this food first of all before you even decide what next you're going to put on your fork and spoon. Or you're not just eating and watching the TV. Or talking to your friends. So the eating is done one thing at a time, mindfully as fully aware. And when you're walking, whatever you're doing, try and be as aware as you possibly can. Being aware does not mean you do things slowly. You can be fully aware when you're running for the bus, as you are when you're walking very slowly and missing your bus in the morning. So mindfulness doesn't mean going slow. You may notice there I changed a couple of words there, falling asleep and waking up. Sorry, it should be sleeping and awake. It's interesting here, what is it, because the falling asleep there, that word has been changed because it doesn't seem to fit the meaning here. It means full awareness in sleeping and full awareness in being awake is the real meaning of those two terms. How can you be fully mindful of sleeping? It shows you, it doesn't mean not just being aware, but fully aware of what the meaning of sleeping, how much you sleep, not too much, not too little. It doesn't mean fully aware actually of being asleep, because when you're asleep, you're not aware. Yeah? you give it extra sleep. So you just know you're aware enough to actually to give the body extra sleep when it needs it. So possessing this aggregate of noble virtue and this noble restraint of the faculties and this possessing this noble mindfulness and full awareness, this is what you do first of all. This is preparation, as it were. They resort to a secluded resting place. The forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, jungle thicket, open space, heap of straw. And on returning from the arms round after the meal, they sit down, folding their legs crosswise, setting their body erect and establishing mindfulness before him. That before them, purakata, means not just physically before them, it means giving it priority. The word prior also means in front, but it doesn't mean spatially in front. It means in your agenda of things to do, this is number one. Which is why the word prioritizing is exactly the same meaning as a Pali word. Not before him, but prior to prioritize. So you prioritize mindfulness when you first sit down and meditate. Now, not talking about watching the breath here, because what is they here? Abandoning covetousness for the world, they abide with the mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness. Abandoning ill will and hatred, you abide with the mind free of ill will. Compassionate for the welfare of all living beings, you purify your mind from ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, you abide free from sloth and torpor. Percipient of light, mindful and fully aware, you purify your mind from sloth and torpor. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, you abide unagitated with a mind inwardly peaceful. You purify your mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, you abide having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states, you purify your mind from doubt. That's, as many of you would know, are the five hindrances. Hindrance number one, covetousness for the world. See, that's exactly what you see in the Satipatthana Sutta. This is the first hindrance, is what you see in the Satipatthana Sutta. Covetous for the world and grief. So these are the five hindrances, but it gives a bit more information of what these five hindrances actually are. The next stage, abandon these five hindrances. What does it mean for so-called covetousness for the world, otherwise known as sensory desire? It actually doesn't mention much, just about purifies your mind for sensory desire. For ill will, it has a bit more. What ill will means, you abide with a mind free of ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings, including yourself. That's what the lack of ill will is. So you have compassion for things. When you have a compassionate mind, even compassionate for the breath, compassionate even for stupid thinking thoughts, then you have abandoned ill will. It's the ill will is the problem. The sensory desire is the first problem. Or, you know, even if you want to use that translation is covetousness. I want jhanas, I want nimittas, I want enlightenment. This is what one is supposed to be abandoning most of all. You're abandoning sloth and torpor. You buy free, percipient of light, mindfully and fully aware. Because when you've got sloth and torpor, you haven't got much mindfulness. And the light is not the nimitta yet. This is just, you know, the idea of like turning on a light in a room so things are illuminated, so you can see things clearly. It doesn't mean there's a light appears in the mind here. It just means that things are clear. And abandoning restlessness and remorse, you abide unagitated with the mind inwardly peaceful. It's brilliant. Because when you are peaceful, sort of the restlessness just vanishes because you love peace. The peace is actually the glue which keeps you happy. And abandoning doubt, you have no doubt at all, unperplexed about wholesome states. You know exactly what you're going for, what's supposed to be happening. So you abandon these five hindrances. Number 20, having thus abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of mind that weaken wisdom. So when you have these hindrances, they weaken wisdom, you can't see clearly. And they're imperfections of the mind, they weaken the mind. Having thus abandoned five hindrances, secluded from unwholesome states, you enter upon the abiding of first jhana, which is accompanied by movement of the mind on to the object and holding the object with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion from the five senses. First jhana. With the stilling of this movement of the mind onto the object and holding the object, you enter upon the abiding the second jhana. And this is a terrible translation, which has the oneness and basically your self-confidence. There's no self-confidence there. It means you've just got so much joy. If you like confidence, that you can completely let go. Confidence actually in the state you're experiencing now. So you can just completely, absolutely let go. And the most important part of it is the rapture and pleasure born of samadhi. Not concentration, but stillness. Absolute still mind. The fading away as well of the rapture part of the bliss, you abide in equanimity and mindful and fully aware, still feeling the pleasure of that experience, not with the physical body. You enter upon the abide in the third jhana, on account of which noble ones announce they have a pleasant abiding who is equanimous and mindful. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, you enter upon abide in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. And even that fourth jhana, they call that upeka sukha, the happiness of equanimity. And each one of these is a deeper and more refined bliss. Any comments about that? Remember how this happens by abandoning the five hindrances. So as many monks have pointed out, and I'm right behind them, the whole path of meditation here, having kept the precepts, simplified your life, sense restraint, practicing mindfulness in your movements, knowing what you're doing, you're building up this awareness, then starting meditating, the whole point of meditation, abandoning the hindrances, abandoning desire and ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, getting some peace in the mind, knowing exactly what's going on. That is the whole purpose of the meditation. So that the jhanas arrive. Any comments about that? Okay, this is just the word. This is the physical and mental unhappiness, unpleasantness. So there's no physical feeling left whatsoever. And no mental unhappiness. So any negativity of the mind, even the slightest, is completely abandoned. Perfectly peaceful. Oh yeah, this is the point where the body is, even by the first jhana, the body has completely been transcended. You can't feel the body anymore. Physical feelings are gone. These are pure six sense states, just mind. So by this time, there's no physical pain gone. This means the previous disappearance of this a long time ago and entering the jhana, no physical pleasure, no physical pain. You're just in mental pleasures. Now you come on to what goes next. When the concentrated mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady and attained to imperturbability. That means after you come out of the jhanas. In the jhanas you can't do anything except just be still here. You direct your mind to knowledge of the recollection of past lives. I think you heard me say on Friday night, one way of doing that is say, what is my earliest memory? And you recollect your manifold past lives. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100,000, 100,000, many eons of world contraction, many eons of world expansion, many eons of world contraction and expansion. In other words, many universal cycles. That's getting a pretty good memory. Now, I don't actually any monks who know whole world cycles, but you do know some monks who have memories of several births. But it's not just unclear memories. You know, there I was so named, of such a clan or family, with such an appearance, such was my food, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my lifetime, and passing away from there I reappeared elsewhere. And there too I was so named, of such a family, of such an appearance, and such was my food, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my lifetime, and passing away from there I reappeared here. Thus with the aspects and particulars you recollect your past lives. Now this is almost like an automatic process, the Buddha says, that when you practice this way, that's basically what you're expected to do. When your stilled mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, you direct it to knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings. With the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, you see beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. He understands how beings pass on according to their karma. Actions is karma. Thus, these worthy beings were ill-conducted in body, speech and mind, revilers of noble ones, wrong in their views, giving effect to wrong view in their actions, and on the dissolution of their body after death have reappeared or reborn in a state of deprivation, in a bad destination, in perdition, even in hell. But these other worthy beings who were well-conducted in body, speech and mind, not revilers of noble ones, right in their views, and what's most important, what you do with your views, here giving effect to right view in their actions on the dissolution of their body after death, have reappeared in a good destination, even in the heaven world. Thus, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, he sees beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and he understands how beings pass on according to their karma. So, with that incredibly powerful mind of jhanas, you can understand the law of karma. So, you know, this law of karma and reincarnation is not something which is culturally added to Buddhism. This is the heart of the practice. This is the gradual training repeated many times. And now, paragraph 26, when your concentrated mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, you direct it to knowledge of the destruction of these taints, these outflowings. He understands actually as it actually is. This is dukkha. You understand actually as it actually is. This is the origin of dukkha. Understand as it actually is. This is the cessation of dukkha. And understand as it actually is. This is the way leading to cessation of dukkha, the Four Noble Truths. You understand as it actually is. These are the outflowings. This word taints, asavas. You can understand this experientially. Just why is it maybe when you're meditating, the mind just goes out to things. It goes out to the past, out to the present, out to the future, sorry, out to the family, you know, out to who's snoring around you, out to anything else. It never actually stays home, never stays in. It always goes outwards. So you understand it as it actually is, what these asavas are. You understand it as it actually is. This is the origin of those asavas, which again is craving. Understand as it actually is. This is the cessation of those craving, of those asavas, the taints. You understand as it actually is. This is the way leading to the cessation of the asavas. Now, once this is done again as a combination of everything which is done before. Just from keeping precepts, simplifying your life, being restrained, being mindful, abandoning the five hindrances, attaining jhanas, seeing the Four Noble Truths. Again, if you understand reincarnation, rebirth and karma, you understand this suffering is not just confined to this life, it's just the whole burden of being reborn again and again and again. Basically, one life is sometimes not enough to understand the full meaning of karma and rebirth. The asavas get less and less, the mind takes more and more charge, they get weakened. Weakened to the point that you see, what's the point of the mind going out? It's not pulled out anymore by craving. So when the craving is destroyed, then the asavas are destroyed. It not always, but can do. If you direct your mind to it, you have a very good chance. How long after a jhana? Well, whenever you come out of a jhana. If you come out of a jhana, sometimes your mind is so peaceful and happy that usually you just want to go straight back in again. You just enjoy the bliss, first of all. But then after a while, just especially if you've had someone like a monk tell you, this is an interesting thing to do, there's a good chance you will actually do it and look for a past life, and there's a good chance it will come up. Yeah, yes, any jhana is enough. However, the deeper the jhana, the more power you have. And of course, paragraph 27, when he or she knows and sees thus, their mind is liberated from the asava, you know, caused by sensual desire, from the asava cause of the wanting to be, the illusion of existence, and from the asava caused by delusion. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. No one is enlightened and they don't know it. If you're enlightened, you know it. See here, it's when it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. You understand thus, birth is destroyed. The seed of birth, the asava, is a craving. It's not there anymore, so there's no way you'll get reborn. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any more state of being. This is your last life. In other words, an enlightened one, an arahat. It's not like an arahat can get reborn again. There is no more coming to any other state of being. This is your last life. No more birth into any state. This monk is called the kind of person who does not torment themselves or pursue the practice of torturing himself, and who does not torment others or pursue the practice of torturing others. The one who, since he torments neither himself nor others, is here and now hungerless, extinguished, and cooled, and abides experiencing bliss, having themselves become holy. So the enlightened one is experiencing bliss. So it's not an unpleasant thing to do. And all along it's more and more bliss as you go along. Correct. Correct. Correct, yes. You understand that each particular stage you've let go of a little bit more of suffering. And the more you let go, the more you simplify, the less you keep attaching to, the more free you feel, the more happiness you have. So all the precepts are just letting go of the coarser forms of suffering. Simplicity is why do you allow these things in the world to hold you back? And sense restraint is using these senses, but not in a way that stops you being happy, by allowing yourself. That's why I said in the book a simple statement, but very profound, never allow anyone else to control your happiness. What you say or do, I'm not going to allow that to stop my happiness. I'm going to guard my senses. Well, if you say something nice, I might keep that. If you say something awful, I'll just let it in one ear out the other. Seeing as well, beauty, ugliness, I can just collect as much as I need for peace and happiness. And the mindfulness, it's not a sort of a painful process. The more aware, again, the more you can sort of avoid pitfalls. And that gives you enough awareness of mindfulness. When you do sit down, you can set up mindfulness pretty quickly. You can abandon these five hindrances, and then you can get into jhanas. You're supposed to be blissing out. Even a few days ago someone said, I thought you're not supposed to have happiness, you get attached to it. And of course, you know, that you've heard me say many times before, anyone who says that they can't be a Buddhist. They may have robes on. But anyone who says, don't get attached to the happiness, they're missing the whole point. You can see in here, you're supposed to get happier and happier and happier. And as you get happier, you get to those states of jhanas, not just the four jhanas, even one of the jhanas would do, but the deeper the better. You can do all these incredible things, like remembering your past lives, understanding the law of karma. And that gives you the big picture of what suffering is. You know, you've had a pretty easy life, Chris. I mean, you know, you haven't had your hand chopped off like some of these poor kids in Africa. You know, you've had a full belly. You know, you've had your suffering with relationships, but it hasn't been that bad. But if you, you know, sometimes people think, well, this life is not that bad. And actually they're quite right. If you look at all the other lives you've had, and where you may go next, and the later part of your life you haven't come to yet, the old age and sickness, and eventually the death process. See the big picture, and then you understand what suffering is. And that gives you that sense of, this is enough. I don't want to keep being reborn again. And then, maybe you might sort of stop your cravings. It's not just a craving for pleasure. It's a craving for being, for existing. Which is even deeper than just wanting to be happy. Just wanting to be. And that will keep you going, just wanting to be. When you see through that, what's the point? Give it up. Then you can let go of that attachment to existence. And that gives you the opportunity to stop. A lot of times when people get into the deep meditations, they can't go deeper because they feel they're disappearing. And that's, you know, your attachment to being. You know, I can't feel, I can't do anything anymore. I can't feel my hands. It's just attachment to being. Little by little, you can't exert your will anymore. Ah. Yeah. It's actually not really dying, because dying, you know, it's just letting go of the five senses. It's actually practicing cessation of you. This is what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. The end of the sutta. That whole section of the gradual training is repeated many, many times, you know, in this book. This is the first place. If you read this book for yourself, just for the sake of saving paper, they would say, see Sutta 51, paragraphs, what was it, 12 to 28. So sometimes, because of abbreviation, we don't realize just how many times this is repeated by the Buddha. It's a central teaching called the gradual path. This is what the Buddha says, this is how one gets enlightened, this is what one does. Especially it's focused on the monastic community, on the monks and nuns. But as Chris pointed out, it doesn't have to be the monk or nun, but you still have to have that virtue to simplify as much as you possibly can. And to also to do such things as abandoning mindfulness practices, abandoning the hindrances, jhanas, remembering past lives. Those are the sorts of things which you can do as well. And then with all that in place, and it gets happier and happier as you go along. It's almost like the happiness is a carrot which keeps you going on. It's not some, I've got to wait till I die before I can get happiness type of religion. You get fed incrementally rewards at every stage to keep you going. To show you, you're on the right path to something interesting and big. So there we go. The gradual path, the gradual training, a central teaching of the Buddha. So any other comments before we finish off? One and then two. Now again, that's one of the, you're saying that in that second jhana, still feeling pleasure with the body. Again, that is a poor translation. Again, when one translates word by word, one comes across the Pali word kaya, body. Body is a very good translation of the particular word, because even in English we have like a body of facts, a body of evidence, a body of truth. A body just means an accumulation of many things. A conglomerate is a body. You have corporate body. So a body is not, sometimes it does refer to the physical body, but not always. And this is very clear, it does not mean the physical body, not the rupakaya, this is a manokaya, the body of mind states referred to as this second jhana. Literally it means an accumulation of that experience, the bliss of that experience, basically, the piti sukha of it. You're still experiencing the happiness in this state. So it's not to be confused with a physical body. No more than a body of evidence has got two legs, two arms and a head. Okay? Yeah. Yes, John? In his early years, he's saying it was Ajahn Chah, very harsh at admonishing monks. In his early years he was, in his later years he wasn't at all. I remember once, before I went to see him, that there was a very, very stubborn novice. And I don't know if it was this novice, but I remember just talking to one of the monks, who was the naughtiest novice? And I remember him saying that the naughtiest novice ever who stayed at this monastery, this was such a cheeky, cruel novice, because they had one of the old monks. And one of the old monks in the afternoon, especially in the hot season, he'd always be sleeping. And so soundly, this little novice actually got up and he had a jackfruit seed. Anyone who knows jackfruits, the seeds, it's quite big. You know, maybe it's about that size, you know, the size between my thumb and finger. So he creeped up to this old monk. This is gross. He tried to insert it into the monk's anus when he was asleep. And of course, it was too tough to go in. So this monk started chewing it, this novice, until it was soft enough he could put it in the monk's backside. And that was supposed to be a joke, so the poor old monk sort of, you know, was constipated. And that was the naughtiest novice they had in those days. And so there's one of these naughty novices, and Ajahn Chah actually slapped him. But he realized that's not the way to do things. He never did that. He did it once and never again. I know he kicked Ajahnana once in Ajahnana's favorite story, but that was not sort of out of anger or ill will at all. But it wasn't sort of to hurt him. But Ajahn Chah, his speech when I was there, it was could be quite firm, but never sort of bad speech, never harsh speech. He never sort of called people stupid or idiotic. When I was stupid and idiotic, he would just laugh. He thought it was terribly funny. And that was actually far more instructive than if he'd have shouted at me. So when I was there, he didn't do that. So harsh speech, it doesn't work. It's a waste of time. You try that on your partner. How many times we use harsh speech on our wife or on our husband? Does it ever work? It doesn't. Come on, it just makes things much worse.